The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I want to share with you a very interesting story from the Talmud, from the Gemara, which always puzzled me, okay? That there's one piece of this story that always puzzled me. Now, just by way of introduction, just so we're all on the same page, you know that there are two parts to Jewish tradition, okay? There is the written tradition, what's called Torah Shebichtav, and that's generally divided up into 24 books, right? The Torah, the five books of Moses, the prophets, the writings, etc. That includes, Isaiah and Ezekiel, right? Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, the books of Shmuel and Kings, the writings of Tehillim, the scrolls, Megillat Esther. And then there's also the oral tradition. Now, we unfortunately live in a time when the oral tradition is written down. We lost the ideal oral tradition in that it was always meant to be transmitted orally. And that's an interesting discussion historically for another time. And the entirety of the oral tradition is basically contained in one way or another within what we call the Gemara, the Talmud. Okay, the Mishnah, the Gemara, all of which was more or less put down on paper over a period, if you include the Mishnah, of about 800 years, okay, in order to prevent Jews from forgetting sort of all these traditions. What people don't realize is that the oral tradition itself, the Gemara, really also consists of two parts. Okay, one part is known as the Halakha, and that's actually the easier part to define. About 90% of the oral tradition is what we call halacha, or the law, the legalities, and that is really the who, what, where, when, and how of Judaism, right? If traditionally we don't light a fire on Shabbat, then that leaves all sorts of questions, you know, so what exactly constitutes a fire, and what if you accidentally light a fire? If we traditionally don't cook on Shabbat, what constitutes cooking, right? I mean, if you pass an egg over a flame for an eighth of a second, is that cooking? How could you avoid cooking? What is a biblical injunction? What's rabbinic? You know, the Torah tells me to put on tefillin, but I don't know what tefillin are. I don't know what color they are. I don't know how to put them on. That's the halacha of the oral tradition. Then there's the second part. The second part only constitutes 5 to 10%, and it's called the Agadah, alright? And that is basically the why. The what for. Okay? And very often people make a mistake because this part of Jewish tradition, also known as Agadata, which contains Midrashim, Jewish legends, very often comes in the form of stories. And so very often when people study this, they just look at them as nice stories. But the Vilna Gaon, and there are many great commentators who believe this, explore the idea that hidden in these stories are all of the major tenets of Judaism. Okay? As a matter of fact, the Vilna Gaon wrote a commentary on a couple of very well-known sections in the Talmud of stories in I think Bechorot, and forget where the second one is, in Baba Basra, in the Talmud. And in those major stories, he, as part of his introduction, suggests, the Vilna Gaon, by the way, was one of probably the greatest rabbi of his generation, really spanned the 18th century. And he was a throwback to a previous time. He was a brilliant, brilliant individual. And he was one of those rarest of individuals that was the undisputed, totally acknowledged leader of his generation. Okay? You can't say that about very many people. Even Maimonides didn't achieve that goal in his lifetime. Right? So the Vilna Gaon suggests that all of the major theological questions, you know, there's so many books out now, right? 9 questions people ask about Judaism, Endless Light, Seeing God. You know, so many different books that deal with some of the major theological and philosophical questions. Says the Vilna Gaon, the truth is that all of these questions are hidden in the stories of the Talmud. Now the reason when they were written down that they were put into story form, as opposed to just sort of theological treatises, really has more to do with whether or not people were ready to understand what were hidden in these stories. And if a person wasn't ready for them or might have abused them, so then they just look like nice stories. And I think also because the challenge of exploring and understanding and deducing what these stories are speaking about is actually part of its value. Having said that, there's a story in the Agadata. It's a fascinating story. Okay? And suggests that Rabbi Yeshua, lived in the time after the destruction of the temple, probably one of the most difficult periods of time for the Jewish people. You know, it's hard for us to imagine what it must have been like for the Jews who lived in Israel and in Babylon in the century or two after the destruction of the temple. I mean, everything was destroyed. The center, you know, the only thing you could compare it to is, God forbid, if Ahmadinejad has his way, and we were, God forbid, to lose the state of Israel, we would be in shock. It would be hard to ever have a celebration. It would be hard to smile, right? And he lives in this time, and the Talmud says that one day he's walking, and he runs into Elijah the prophet. He runs into Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, I should point out that there is an interesting debate as to whether one is meant to take these stories literally. I personally subscribe to the school of thought that suggests that that's not really the purpose of these stories. I'm not saying that some of them didn't happen. I'm sure some of them did. But the goal of these stories is not to teach me history. It's not to tell me that Rabbi Yeshua was a great man and bumped into Eliyahu. There's a message here. And there are many, many great commentators who believe that these stories are not meant to be taken literally. Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato of the 18th century, the Vilna Gaon, by the way, the Ramban. So I'm going to allow the Rashbam, I'm going to allow myself to assume that that's correct. But you should know that there are different opinions. In any case, so let's assume that this is the original version of what later became the Hasidic story. Okay, Rabbi Yeshua, one of the great rabbis of his generation, bumps into Eliyahu HaNavi, right? And they have this little back and forth, oh, you know, my master, my teacher, oh, my master, my son, right? And then it's clear that Eliyahu HaNavi, you know, wants, you know, is allowing Rabbi Yeshua to ask a question. So Rabbi Yeshua says to Eliyahu HaNavi, to Elijah the prophet, right? Ematai ka'atimar. When is the master coming? Now there's a tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi will come to herald the coming of redemption. That when redemption comes, Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, who at least according to Jewish tradition never really died, that's a story for another time, he will come to tell people to get ready because the Mashiach, the Messiah, is coming. Okay. But that's not what Rabbi Yeshua is asking. Rabbi Yeshua is asking, when is the actual Mashiach coming? When is he coming? How long do we have to wait? Remember, the first temple was destroyed. 70 years later, they had a second temple. Rabbi Yeshua lived in the time round about the Bar Kokhba and after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Very, very difficult time. So, 70 years have passed, and the third temple is not being built. When is he coming? So Eliyahu HaNavi says, Hayom, today. Now, that's an amazing thing. Now, if you're the great Rabbi Yeshua, and Nach, you bump into Elijah the prophet, and Nach, you ask him when Mashiach is coming, and he tells you today. So the Talmud, the Gemara, doesn't tell me what Rabbi Yeshua does. But I got to imagine Rabbi Yeshua, I mean, I don't know, he calls up CNN, he sends out a newsletter to Reuters, he goes home and tells his wife, forget everything, pack the stuff, don't bother with, you know, the bill that we owe in the grocery, let's go! He runs through his town, everybody, come on, get your cars, let's go, we're going in, so the Mashiach's coming, right? No, never. The Mashiach doesn't come. And Rabbi Yeshua must be devastated. I mean, he's got the whole town. You know, I remember when I was in Pittsburgh for a year, there was flyers going around from Lubavitch. Mamash, the Mashiach is coming on Monday. Redemption is coming on Monday. And there were little children, I remember this, I don't know if any of you remember this, and there were little children sort of walking in the streets handing out these flyers, prepare, because this is our last Shabbos in the exile, we're all going home on Monday. And I remember I was in a kosher meat store there with my wife, and one of these kids gave us this flyer. And so, you know, she looked at it and she said, you know, and I was thinking, these kids, if the Mashiach, and look, the Mashiach could come on Monday, who am I to say they're wrong? But if he doesn't come on Monday, these kids are going to be devastated, which of course is exactly what happened. So Rabbi Yeshua must have been destroyed. And the Gemara doesn't tell me. However, the Talmud does continue and says that the next day, Rabbi Yeshua, right, okay, it bumps into Eliyahu, right? And there's another version that says that this is all part of the same conversation. And he says, well, when is Mashiach coming? And Eliyahu HaNavi says, well, why don't you ask him? Ask him. So Rabbi Yeshua says, ask him, well, where is he? So Eliyahu says, well, go to the marketplace, and at the entrance to the marketplace sit all the beggars and the lepers. And if you notice carefully, you'll see that that all the lepers take off their, right? Leprosy is a skin disease of sorts, right? Sarat, it's also a mystical disease, but whatever. And all these beggars and lepers are sitting in the entrance to the marketplace, and the lepers take off their bandages in the sun so that the sun can help to heal their wounds. But there's one leper who only takes off one bandage at a time so that he can be ready to go if he's called. That leper is Mashiach. Go ask him. Now, if you're Rabbi Yeshua, and you run into Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, and he tells you that Mashiach is sitting in the marketplace, and he describes him to you, so you go to the marketplace. So Rabbi Yeshua goes to the marketplace. Okay? Goes to the marketplace, and sure enough, he sees a leper who's only taking off one bandage at a time. So he goes over to the leper, and he says to the leper, Nu ematai ka atimar, when are you coming? And the leper says, today, hayom. And again, Rabbi Yeshua must be thrilled, and he runs home, and he's so excited. But of course, the Mashiach didn't come. So again, the Gemara doesn't tell me what happened. But the next day, Rabbi Yeshua bumps into Eliyahu Navi, he bumps into Elijah the prophet. And again, they have this back and forth, Shalom Alecha Rabbi Mori, Shalom Alecha Yerba. And he says to him, Nu, did you go to see Mashiach? Did you meet him? Did you ask him? And Rabbi Yeshua says, Cain. And in one of the most painful lines in the entire Talmud, Rabbi Yeshua adds, speaking to Elijah the prophet, allegorically, Vekoshchi Kerli. Yeah, I ran into him. And he told me when he's coming, and he lied to me. So Rabbi Yeshua says, and so Elijah the prophet says, he lied to you. What do you mean he lied to you? So Rabbi Yeshua says, I asked him when he's coming, and he said, Hayom. He told me he was coming today. And today passed, yesterday passed, and he didn't come. So Eliyahu Navi looks at Rabbi Yeshua and says, you don't understand. He wasn't saying Hayom. He was quoting a verse. The verse says, Hayom im bekolot tishmau. Today, if you will but listen to his voice. In other words, he could come today. He could come tomorrow. It's completely dependent on us. Right? And that Talmudic story, you know, is generally perceived to be the opportunity to sort of take a little bit of ownership for why the world isn't what it's meant to be. And if we want the world to be better, we have to do our bit. And that's a very appropriate message, by the way, given that this coming week we're going to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, right? Some 60 years ago, or 150 years ago even, in Europe, a group of Jews, among them some significant rabbis, decided that enough was enough. If God wasn't going to bring us home, we were going to have to force God's hand, as it were, and go home. There's a Kabbalistic idea. If you want to create the Neturata de Ela, a stirring in the heavens, you have to create the Neturata de Latata, a stirring down below. And that's what they did. And they created an organization called the Chovavei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion, which was one of the beginnings of the modern Zionistic river that brought the Jews back to Israel and created the State of Israel. Okay. But there is one detail in that story that always puzzled me. Why is the Mashiach depicted as a leper? I mean, let him be depicted as a beggar. Let him be depicted as a wealthy man. Why specifically a leper? And since this story is one of the fundamental stories in the Talmud about how we're supposed to view redemption, and more importantly, how we can play a role in hastening the redemption, in bringing peace to the world. So there must be some message, some idea that's hidden in this choice of allegorical form. Why is the Mashiach? Why is, by the way, in Judaism, you know, many people hear the word Mashiach, which is translated as Messiah, and they have this very Christian perspective. In Judaism, the Mashiach is not some magical, mythical figure who walks on water. The Mashiach comes from the word Mashuach, to be anointed. Every king of Israel was anointed with a drop of oil on his forehead. We've spoken about this before. That's because the oil represents, oil is basically a vehicle for light. Okay? And that's what a leader is meant to be. That's what the king was meant to be. A vehicle to bring light into the world, right? The oil is not the light. It's just the vehicle to bring light. So that's why it's called Mashiach. And in Jewish tradition, although there are some disparity of opinions on the matter and divergence of opinions, nonetheless, if you follow Maimonides, which sort of works for me, so the Mashiach is simply a very charismatic, extremely ethical human being, a tremendous Torah scholar, who would be on the level that the entire Jewish people would be willing to follow him itself, of course. I mean, that alone would be such an amazing miracle that it would mean Mashiach was here. Right? So why is this Mashiach a leper? So in order to understand that, we have to take a look at leprosy. Now, the word tzaraat is not really exactly leprosy. I'm going to use the word leprosy for the purpose of this discussion, but you should know that leprosy is a physical medical disease, and tzaraat is a little bit different. It very much resembles leprosy, but it is not something, at least according to Jewish tradition, that subscribes to the rules of leprosy. For example, if a leper is sitting next to you and comes into physical contact with you, you can become a leper. But if a person with tzaraat is sitting next to you, that need not mean at all that you're going to become a leper. Because only if you went through the spiritual journey or mistakes that he went through will you then succumb to tzaraat. So there are differences. Okay, so there's a couple of interesting details about tzaraat that are worth noticing. Okay, first of all, these portions, right, Tazria Matzora, really focus on the different aspects of this malady which we know as tzaraat. Okay? Tzaraat could affect your home. You could see a sort of something resembling a mold spot on your home. It could affect your clothing. Okay? And it could affect your person. A person could be diagnosed with tzaraat. How? I mean, it's a complex series of laws. There's a whole series of Mishnah called Negaim, which deals with the laws of tzaraat, of how to recognize it, right? But essentially, You will see a white spot or a couple of white hairs in the middle of a white spot or whatever it might be on a person's skin. And if a person is diagnosed with tzaraat, then essentially what he has to do is he has to remove himself from society. Now, the exact process for doing that is an interesting discussion, but basically he will be confined to his home for 7 days. And at the end of 7 days, if the tzaraat is gone, then, you know, he's free to come and go, but he has to come up to the temple and he brings a korban, he brings a sacrifice, and whatever it might be. And if it's not, he goes through the process again, etc., 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 etc. One of the most interesting details about tzaraat, interestingly enough, is the process of diagnosis. The only person who could declare someone to have tzaraat, which would then sort of begin, you know, this 1 day and then 7 day process and demand of a person certain sacrifices and whatnot, the only person who could diagnose this is actually a Kohen. Now that's very interesting, okay? A Kohen, a priest, someone who's descended of a priest, who's descended of a priest, who's descended of a priest, all the way back to the times of Aaron, right? Such a person could be the one to diagnose tzaraat. In other words, if you see a friend, and you're living in the times of the temple in Israel, and this friend has something that looks like a couple of white skin hairs, or whatever it might be, right? And it's interesting, by the way, that the Rav Pninim, one of the commentaries in the Torah, points out something very interesting. What does it mean that the hairs in the middle of the skin turn white? So white symbolizes one of two things. Sometimes it symbolizes purity, and sometimes it symbolizes death. And that's because those two things are very much connected. Right? It's like when the grass turns white. When the grass grows white, that's because it's dying. Right, when a plant turns white, it's because it's dying. But when a person's hair turns white, it's because he's aging, right? You notice that if I was 20, I would say it's because he's dying, but now that I'm 43, so it's just that he's aging, right? I had actually 3 days of reserve duty this week. I discovered all too well the deep implications of aging. But in any event, it's a sign, almost, that a person on a certain level is really worthy of death. There's something that you're doing on a spiritual level that is removing, to some degree, your right to be in this world, right? If we're created by God, then that means that we have a purpose. And that purpose is to make the world a better place. And there's certain things that we can do that can so undermine our ability to make the world a better place that we don't really deserve to be here anymore. It's interesting that the rabbis associate, Jewish tradition associates tzaraat, right, with lashon hara, okay, with slander, Okay? And that's because the word tzarat, right, resembles, right? Yetzerah resembles the lashon ra, right? And there's a whole discussion about what the resemblance is. And the general principle is that a person who slanders another human being in the time of the temple, and perhaps even after the time of the temple, and perhaps only in Israel, perhaps even in the exile, would then suffer tzarat. Okay? But here's an interesting detail. The laws of tzarat are actually pretty complex. And in order for a kohen to diagnose this, he had to learn a lot of halacha, right? In fact, a person could not serve in the temple as a kohen, okay, below the age of 25, and traditionally the Talmud talks about this, they would go from the time that they were bar mitzvah, okay, from age 13, and they would learn. They went to a yeshiva for kohenim. As a matter of fact, there is such a place in Israel, in the old city of Yerushalayim, there is a yeshiva called Torat Kohanim, and much of what they learn, okay, it's not just kohenim, but priests, but much of what they learn are the laws related to kuna, to the priesthood. So that if one day they rebuild the temple, these guys will know what to do, and it's not a simple thing. So he had to do a lot of learning in the laws of tzarat in order to be able to diagnose tzarat. Okay? But here's the interesting rub. You see, the only person that can actually diagnose tzarat, who can actually say the words that he is a metzora, that he is in fact we'll call it a leper, right? Thus necessitating this setting him aside, exile, and everything else that went on, was a kohen. Imagine that you have the greatest Torah scholar alive. I mean, I don't know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, of Moshe Feinstein. Okay? And they look at somebody's skin, and they know with absolute certainty, because they know the laws of tzarat, that this person has tzarat, he has this leprosy. They cannot pronounce him to be a leper if there's no kohen there. Only a kohen can pronounce a leper to be a leper, a tzarat to be a metzora to be a metzora. Right? In fact, if you have a tremendous Torah scholar present, and the only kohen that's there is a blind kohen, so that he can't even see the tzarat, the Torah scholar, if there's no other kohen available, the Torah scholar, and the Rambam talks about this is how he rules, Maimonides, the Torah scholar looks at the nega, explains to the kohen exactly what he's seeing and why he's convinced it's tzarat, and then the blind kohen to declare it tzarat, can declare it, in fact, tzarat. So that's very strange. The Gemara goes even further, and the Talmud, right, and the Rambam. If you have a katan, if you have a minor, a boy who's 7, 8 years old, right, and he's the only kohen available, okay, and you have tremendous Torah scholars, and they all agree it's tzarat, okay, if this kid is not old enough to be able to say it's tzarat, right, then they can't declare him a metzorah. And he has to continue hunting until he finds a kohen. Why is that? Why is it specifically a kohen that needs to declare a person to have tzarat? Right? And what is the essence of this tzarat? So I want to share with you two ideas. And, you know, this is very powerful. And in order to understand the connection with these two ideas, we have to understand really what a kohen is. Okay? A kohen basically, and you find this all over Chazal, all over tradition, there's an amazing sicha, a discussion of the Lubavitcher Rebbe that discusses this idea, right? A kohen basically is a conduit for blessing. As a matter of fact, in the book of Bamidbar of Numbers, it suggests, right, that God tells the kohenim, Ko tevarchun et bnei Israel. This is how you shall bless the Jewish people. And the rabbis ask there, what do you mean? Why is God telling the kohenim to bless the Jewish people? Let God bless the Jewish people, because there needs to be an entity, right, that is a vehicle for blessing. The kohenim somehow carry with them the ability to bless, right, to bring blessing. Why do they carry the ability to bless? So on a contextual level of the Torah, it's because the source of priesthood, Aaron, epitomized love for one's fellow human being. Right? The Mishnah says in Ethics of the Fathers, the rabbi suggests that he was known as the Ohev Shalom, but the Rodef Shalom. That he was the lover of peace, okay, and the pursuer of peace. On a mystical level, okay, I think this is in the Zohar, but if you send me an email, I can find it for you, right? But on a mystical level, okay, there's an idea that somehow the reason the Kohanim were designated to be these conduits for this divine blessing is because their souls, the neshamot of Kohanim, somehow evolved from love itself. And that's a whole interesting discussion, this chamber of love, whatever you want to call it, right? But there is this idea that the Kohen represents pure love of one human being for another. Now, without getting into why the Kohanim represent that and what that means, that's a very powerful idea. Because what's really going on when a Kohen tells another Jew that he has tzarat? What the Kohen is basically suggesting, right, is that you've done something that necessitates the consequence of you being set aside from society. You've committed an act that so undoes the basic underpinnings of society, that so violates the social contract of human beings learning to live together, that the society is better off without you in it temporarily. That is a very harsh thing to say. That's a very powerful criticism, right? It's interesting, by the way, that you have to be on a certain level in order to receive such criticism. But perhaps what the Torah is telling us, which is something to think about, is that the only way to be able to give that type of critique is if it comes out of love, right? And you may say, well, there are many people who have love, and that's true. But we're not talking about the specifics of whether, by the way, the opposite is also true. If a Kohen, very interesting halacha, very interesting tradition, you know that traditionally the Kohanim, the priests, bless the congregation every day. Okay, every morning there's a special place in the prayers where the Kohanim actually give the Birchat Kohanim the prayer, the blessings. Ashkenazic Jewry in the diaspora do not merit this except on the holidays, on the festivals. But in Israel, we do this every day. Sephardim also do this every day, right? It's an amazing thing. You go to shul, and there's a moment in the prayer service, right, where you stop, and a group of your neighbors, who happen to be Kohanim, go up in front of the whole congregation, and they take a moment to just be a vehicle for blessing. Just to want good to come into your life. In fact, there's a very powerful bracha. The blessing that the Kohen makes on this mitzvah of blessing the Jewish people, right, is that Hashem has commanded us, l'kadesh et amo Yisrael b'ahava, to sanctify, right, His people Israel with love. Now, what does it mean, l'kadesh? So we've spoken about this before. Kedusha, holiness, is when something becomes a vehicle for bringing God into the world, right? That's why a kiddush, that's why you make kiddush. Okay, that's any item that becomes a vehicle for bringing God into the world becomes kadosh, right? In this instance, the item that's being a vehicle to bring God into the world are the Kohanim. And through love, they bring Hashem into the world. Okay? And Rav Kook suggests, you know, there are two possibilities. Some say that the bracha means that they're commanded to bless us with love, to give us the gift of love. But some say that they're commanded to bless us in a state of loving us. If you're a Kohen and there's someone in the congregation that you can't stand, you've got a real problem. You're not supposed to be up there for Birchat Kohanim, for the blessing. And even more fascinating, if there is a Kohen that is hated by anyone in the congregation, okay, if one guy in shul, and I actually know of a case where this happened, okay, if one guy in the shul, in the synagogue, can't stand one of the Kohanim, then that Kohen is not supposed to duchen, he's not supposed to go up and bless the people. And I know a specific case where two fellows were involved in a litigation, and it turned ugly, and one of them was a Kohen. And the fellow went up to the rabbi before Birchat Kohanim and said, if that fellow goes up to bless the congregation for Birchat Kohanim, I'm going to walk out of the shul. And he said to him, it's a halacha. You can't allow him to go up. And the rabbi, to his credit, walked over to the Kohen beforehand and found an excuse and said, I need a favor from you. I need you to do me a favor and to go. And he managed to get him to send him to go somewhere to do something, and he wasn't in the shul. Powerful. If your blessing is not out of love, then you're not going to be able to fulfill. By the way, a Kohen who was not married could not serve in the temple. Because until a Kohen developed his own relationship with love, until he learned to be able to give to another on that level of commitment which marriage demands, he wasn't ready to be a vehicle for bringing Hashem into the lives of the Jewish people. He wasn't ready to be a vehicle of love and a vehicle of blessing. Only a person who's on that level, who's a vehicle of love and blessing to such an extent, is ready and able to tell someone that they need to fix themselves. And that, by the way, is a whole world of discussion in terms of the underlying question here, which is what we call tochacha, right? To critique someone. You know, it's interesting that leadership involves many things. And sometimes leadership means that you have to be willing to say that which people don't always want to hear. Right? So what does that mean? I mean, think about it. Sometimes you need to be able to stand up and tell your congregants that they're doing something wrong. But you can't stand up and tell them they're doing something wrong unless you really think they're going to listen to you. And in order for you to think that they're going to listen to you, you have to believe that they love you. And the only way you could even entertain the thought that they love you is if you love them. You know, it's interesting. Tochacha has to come, critique has to come out of love. In fact, if you're criticizing someone, one of the first things, and by the way, this is hidden in the counting of the Omer, which we're in the middle of, but if you're critiquing someone, one of the questions you have to ask yourself before you're ready to do that is, am I doing this because I so love this person? Or am I doing this as an act of selfishness because she's ticked me off or he ticked me off? And if you can't answer the question, or worse, if you have the wrong answer to the question, then you should remain silent. You know, there's no guarantee that critique accomplishes anything when it is done out of love, right? And even when you know that the other person loves you. But for sure, if it's not done out of love, it's not going to get you anywhere. And that's hidden in the story of the Metzora, which, by the way, brings us back to the story in the Talmud. So why is the Mashiach a leper, right? What is that about? Because ultimately the Mashiach is meant to be a tzaddik, a tzaddik. And we've all heard the term tzaddik, and generally people translate it to mean a righteous person. But to be a tzaddik is much deeper than that. The best definition I ever heard of a tzaddik was from Rav Tversky from Pittsburgh. He once, as an aside, mentioned this, and it stuck with me. The definition of a tzaddik is someone who cares for someone else so much that their pain is his pain. Right? And by the way, not just their pain, but their joy. If you go to a wedding, right, do you feel the joy of the person who's getting married as much as they do? Most of us aren't on that level. But if you're a tzaddik and you're at a wedding, right, then by definition, you are so full of joy because the other person's joy is what brings you joy. And when another person is in pain, it brings you pain. And maybe I can't speak for anyone else on the line except for myself, but you know, most of us are not on that level, right? We're not tzaddikim. But we can aspire to be tzaddikim. We can try to become better, right? The message of a tzaddik is that all of us can try to inculcate, to feel the pain and the joy of our fellow human beings. Maybe that's why the Mashiach in this allegory is a leper. Because if leprosy is about the mistake of slander, and by the way, slander is a very, very big deal. The Chafetz Chaim, who was absolutely the greatest rabbi of his day, 100 years ago, wrote a whole book on why he believed that gossip and slander were the mistake, the iniquity, the sin that the Jewish people were committing that was preventing us from coming home and preventing us from peace and redemption and all the things that we so long for, right? And very often, we're in such a muck that we don't even realize that we have this problem. You know, the Ramban, Nachmanides, says a very interesting thing. He says, what happened to Tzaraat? Where is Tzaraat today? How come we don't have this anymore? So he says, the truth is that on a certain level, Tzaraat, leprosy, is a gift. And to quote him, he says, it's because Siman hu she'ashem sar me'alav. Right? When you get Tzaraat, it's a sign that you've become distant from God. And that's actually a gift. Right? You know, I have someone that I'm very close with who a number of years ago, he's a doctor and he was walking up the hill. He used to take the bus every day. He liked to take the bus. And he was coming from the bus and walking up a steep hill to his house and he felt a tightening in his chest. Right? And it bothered him. And he felt this a couple of days and he decided to, so he went back to the hospital where we worked and he checked himself in and he did some tests. Now you and me, most of us, like, you know, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't think twice about a little tightening in my chest. Like, okay, so what's that? Let's see, have a cramp. But, you know, he's a doctor and he's a radiologist and he's, you know, versed in these things. And thank God he checked himself in because they discovered that his arteries were so blocked, right? He needed a quadruple bypass and he had it almost immediately, you know? And it was a gift, by the way. And ever since then, and thank God he was in good shape, and now he got very into dieting and all these different healthy eating and everything else, right? That was a gift. That tightening of the chest, which might be uncomfortable, is a bracha. Hashem is giving you a gift. He's telling you something's wrong. right? What's the problem? The problem is that tzarat is a gift, that something's wrong. You have to be on a certain spiritual level, right, in order to appreciate that gift, right? If an alarm bell rings, but there's so much other noise going on, jets are flying overhead, that you can't hear it, there's no value to it. So we, you know, we're not on the level that they used to be on in the time of the temple where they had one mistake or two mistakes. We have so much muck in our lives that if one piece of tzarat came along, you know, we wouldn't know what to do. We wouldn't even notice it. So we hope to get back to the level. I mean, imagine if every time you spoke slander, your tongue hurt. That would actually be unbelievable. Because then you would stop speaking slander. It would be a gift. Unfortunately, as a community, we do this so often, we've become immune to it. We don't even realize it. We actually think it's a mitzvah, right? It's a mitzvah to go to shul and slander your fellow human being because that's what makes shul fun, right? Very challenging. So the Mashiach, this righteous person that we're waiting for, this leadership, I want you to know if there was ever a time in the history of the state of Israel where we need leadership, I can't think of a better one. There is such a dearth of leadership in this country and in the Jewish world in general. Rabbinic leadership, educational leadership, and especially political leadership, all of it. And it all comes from a problem in our educational system, right? And that's perhaps what this allegory is saying. The Mashiach is sitting as a leper because the definition of someone who could achieve that level to be loved by the entire Jewish people is that he so feels and identifies with the mistakes that the Jewish people are making that he becomes the Minugat Sarat, the person with leprosy. And the goal of redemption is that one by one, we have to be able to remove the bandages. We have to be able to heal. And so that's one of the hidden messages sort of behind the double portion of Metzorah and Tazria, Tazria and Metzorah. And I hope, Bezrat Hashem, you know, I'll tell you one last thing and then I'll open up the floor to questions. I was in Milim this week in reserve duty. I haven't done this kind of reserve duty in a long time, and I will sleep well this Shabbos. But in any event, it happened to be that the first day of when I was in the army was Monday, which was Yom HaShoah, and Holocaust Memorial Day. And the night before was such a powerful experience. There's a public ceremony here in Efrat, and most of the city comes. And this year they decided that the ceremony would be based on the next generation. That the, you know, the Holocaust survivors are growing older, and there aren't as many of them as there used to be, and the next generation has to begin to take the responsibility to remember what happened, right? So the Noah of Efrat, the teens of Efrat, got together from the different high schools and the different youth movements, and they put on, some of them had gone on March of the Living, and they put on this ceremony. It was unbelievable. It was just unbelievable with how they did it. And so it was such a powerful evening. And, you know, they were telling stories, and at one point, one of the kids comes out with a guitar, and another kid is singing, and just everybody's crying. It was very powerful. Then the next morning, I was in the army, and I kind of forgot that it was Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day, because we were dealing with, you know, we were less thinking about the Holocaust that happened, and more dealing with making sure the next one doesn't happen. And then at one point, we're in a briefing from the brigade commander, going through sort of, well, whatever we were going through, and he says, okay, listen, we're going to take a half an hour off from this exercise, and we're going to walk down to the center of the base, and, you know, for Yom HaShoah. So I didn't know what was going on. We walked down to the middle of the base, and all the different soldiers, you know, from the base come, and there's like 200 guys. And at 10 o'clock exactly, or whatever it was, I think it was 10 o'clock, the siren goes off, and they lower, and it was a whole ceremony. We had to stand at attention, and then we had to, you know, they presented the mizdar, the inspection to the brigade commander, to the base commander, and then they lowered down the flag to half-mast, and just before they lowered the flag, a lot of us are reserve duty soldiers, and we haven't done this sort of thing in a long time, they announced that, you know, if you're an officer, you have to salute, and if you're a regular non-com, so you, you know, whatever, you stand at attention. I have not saluted or needed to salute officially. You know, the Israeli army, you don't salute. I mean, after basic training, like, nobody salutes an officer. Like, that's one of the powerful things about the Israeli army. People stop calling you sir, they call you Binny. Right? And that's very powerful. And that's why I think, you know, we're so close with our men. So I don't remember the last time that I was in a situation in the army where I had to salute. So all of a sudden you find yourself saluting. You have to look at this flag as it's being lowered to half mast. And I wasn't expecting a powerful moment because I didn't know what we were doing there. It was such a thought-provoking moment. You're remembering the Holocaust in an army uniform, at an army base, as an officer in a Jewish army. I mean, could there be a more appropriate memorial than that to who they were? You know? So on the one hand, we're going through very difficult times, and the prognosis is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that's true both physically on the northern border in Lebanon and with what's going on in the Gaza Strip, and I think also in Yudan Shomron, as well as with spiritually. You know, we have a lot of work to do. And yet at the same time, we have come so far. You know, and maybe the message of Tzaraat on a certain level is that sometimes we need to recognize that we have certain afflictions and we need to step aside. We need to set ourselves off and figure out what we need to do to fix it. And so God willing, Yihiratzon, we will find the way to be better, to become better, to dream better, in order that one day we can all be in a better home.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.